Welcome to Non-Fungible Rebels, a podcast where creators, tech, internet culture, crypto, and marketing meet each other. It's me, Annie Alexander, and in each episode, me and the Rebels will have a real unscripted talk, share genuine opinions, and show raw emotions. Should we start? Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Non-Fungible Rebels. It's me again, Annie Alexander, and today I have a very special episode because it's really down my realm. It's really down one of my passions. It's going to be related to fiction and poetry and everything else. So I'm really very happy to sort of look at that side of the story. We never covered anything similar to this before. So very happy to have a crypto poet. I mean, poet, obviously, but also someone who's very active using the technology for sharing her art with us, Ana Maria Caballero. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Ani. Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we met. I mean, I keep telling my audience by now, probably already knows, because I've told so many times that in the very beginning, when the NFT boom was coming up, and you know, we didn't really have so much noise with 10k PFP projects, and it was mainly artists in the space. We had this really cozy, nice, warm sort of environment where we would spend time in Twitter spaces, and we would, you know, find out about each other, and we would have really nice conversations. And I think that's when I met you, probably back like 3 years ago or somewhere like that, when we were just, you know, part of NFT artist communities. So since then, we had a long journey because so much has changed since then. Many people who have been around, unfortunately, are not really around. Very few sort of kept consistently producing art and you know, sticking to it and just going forward and not losing the conviction, even in that quite long crypto winter and bear market. And yeah, I mean, you were one of those people who I could see sort of, you know, just growing and growing consistently. And it's really nice to see your success, because I think, like, you know, people who deserve it should eventually get there, right? So really happy to see where you're at. So let's just start from the very beginning. Can you tell me, like, how did you end up in this space? How did you discover the crypto space?
Well, I've been a lifelong poet, writing, you know, since I was a child. I've published 5 books in both Spanish and English, Ani, and I have a 6th book coming out in May of this year, of 2024, and I'm working on another one for 2025. So all this to say that I'm constantly writing and looking to publish my work. I'm writing and authoring. Authoring is, you know, the process by which we get our work out into the world. So editing, revising, and submitting, which is as time consuming and as complex sometimes as the creation of the work itself, as any writer knows. So I devote a significant amount of my life, and have done so, to books, to traditional publishing. So I know the publishing world quite well. I know the experience of publishing. The work that I write is quite experimental. And so I've only published with independent presses, with you know, sort of, I would say, bold, small indie presses. And so, you know, I know that the difficulties that apply, you know, independent presses are always typically struggling presses. And as soon as I read about Web3 and digital assets, blockchain provenance, it all made so much sense to me. I always felt that there should be more for poets. There should be more for writers. There should be a way for us to transact our work in a way that honors and reflects our contribution to culture while maintaining sort of freedom of press, in the sense of freedom of readership, right? Not in the traditional sense, but in the sense that anyone could read my poem, but perhaps one person who can afford to might collect it in a way that gives me sustenance and that sustains my poetic practice. Poets don't really have a way of making a living from our craft. And I don't count teaching poetry as practicing a poet. You will speak to, you know, a number of poets who are teachers, professors, you know, at top universities worldwide, and still teaching is a job. It's very different from waking up in the morning and writing poems and publishing them. You know, artists, for example, screenwriters, directors can one day hope to make a living from the craft, but for poets, that's truly not possible. And I believe that blockchain provenance can prove revolutionary for poets. We are still right at the beginning of a transformation, but it's only going to become more and more pronounced.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. And I think back in the day, like self-publishing kind of made that one step closer to the readers, and sort of, we ended up being free and didn't really need to have literary agents to represent us, publishing houses to approve our work and decide that we're good enough. So that was like one layer that was taken off back in the days, and self-publishing kind of brought in lots of fresh blood into the space, lots of people who were denied by, you know, the critics who had their own certain sort of, you know, commercial requirements into the potential of your work, right? And here with the blockchain technology, we went even one step even further and ended up with this special relationship between you and your collector and the public proof of it. And I think there is something really special in there. And I do agree with you, poetry probably, like, you know, from literary artwork, poetry is the one that is hardest to sell just because of its popularity at the moment. And I feel like it's very challenging. So in the very beginning, when you discovered the space, then it totally made sense for you. Back in the days, I believe it was a very popular and vibrant place, unlike the winter that came afterwards. How did you navigate the space? Like, you know, I'm sure as when people come in, it's a bit overwhelming. There's a lot of things to learn, to figure out, to navigate, to just, you know, look around and understand how you could find your own sort of, you know, approach to it. What was your process like? Yeah, what was your experience getting into this?
You know, it's very, very difficult. And I think that it's important for people to acknowledge the difficulty of navigating and understanding the Web3 space. Like you said, Amy, it's quite overwhelming. There's so much information. The UX UI is very clunky. You know, there's quite a steep ladder to learn how to use a wallet, how to get crypto. It's hard to get crypto, and you need crypto in order to record or mint your works onto the blockchain in order to really get started. So I think that there is a real difficulty in beginning, and it would be great to have more and more tools, more and more podcasts, more and more information about how to get started. But at the end of the day, like most things in life, you learn by doing, and you learn by making mistakes, and nobody can hold your hand all the way through. And so it's a lot of time that you invest. It's a lot of time on Twitter, because that's really the scene, the stage where things are playing out, and you can learn a lot observing and watching how things are happening. There's platforms that have come and gone. But at the end of the day, Twitter is where most of it happens. That's a debatable strength or weakness to Web3. But there is a significant amount of time that I think needs to be invested on Twitter or Warpcaster, now Farcaster, which is one of the emerging ones. And this needs to be placed front and center for any person. You know, it's not enough to open up a wallet, to learn how OpenSea works. If you really want to get immersed into Web3, you need to open up a Twitter account and get active on Twitter. That is just the reality of how it works. I think going to Web3 events has also been very, very eye-opening for me. I found meeting people and seeing how what happens in person is reflected then commercially. Also, I think that that's an important side to the art market. And it's just Web3 in a way maturing to what the art market is, which is a lot of presenting yourself and your story in an evocative and compelling way, both in person and online. Because at the end of the day, people are buying your journey, right? They're investing in you as an artist because they believe in where you're going.
Yeah. No, totally makes sense. And I agree with you about the events because I think, like, you know, Twitter is good and online interaction is really great when, because you have a chance to meet people all over the world that way. But nothing really replaces that real life interaction and kind of meeting people in person. And I feel like you can create deeper relationships and build trust so much faster that way, meeting people in real life versus just, you know, online. So I totally get that. And I agree with you, like, you know, spending time within the communities and spending time at where the action is happening is very important, because at the end of the day, you need to be visible. People have to know you. People have to know what you're creating. And that takes time, that, you know, until you start establishing yourself, and also kind of, you know, it takes time of engaging. You can't just post your stuff out there and hope that everyone is going to see it. And, you know, without engaging with your audience, you can't really, you know, expect them to become fans, to buy your art and all that. But for many, keeping that balance is challenging. Like, you know, how much time do you spend doing that versus how much time do you spend actually creating the thing, right? You know, creation versus promotion is a bit of a challenge, figuring out the right balance. So how do you deal with that aspect of the work?
Well, it's a struggle. And I think that anyone that you speak to candidly acknowledges also the struggle. Indeed, I've created a collection with this brilliant, brilliant generative artist named Melissa Vidarecht that we're releasing next week at Art Dubai with Gazelli Art House, called Miss Metaverse, which uses the beauty pageant narrative and language to deliver satire and commentary on the toll that presenting ourselves online takes for digital artists. There is a semantics, there are rules, there are value statements that we need to satisfy. We need to speak a certain way, you know, express ourselves a certain way in order to be quote unquote read and perceived and then collected. And of course, you know, as much as I think collectors sometimes can support an artist, right, by facilitating an exhibition or by boosting our posts online, that's all very helpful. But at the end of the day, what has really transformed my life, Annie, are the collectors who have acquired my work in a meaningful way. And that bursts open doors. It really, truly does, because then, of course, opportunities start coming in, new galleries start looking your way, new collectors start looking your way as well. And so I think that these significant milestones, these significant acquisitions happen often because we've learned how to talk the talk, right?
Yeah.
But that it is exhausting, and sometimes we feel disjointed from ourselves, from our essence as artists, right? Like I'm a poet. There's nothing more opposite to the life of a poet, perhaps, than the stage that is Twitter. I need quiet, reflection, pause. I need, you know, to read and to digest thoughts and ideas. And then to edit. Editing takes as long as writing, or longer than writing the poem. And all this is very, very opposite from the life of promoting the work. And sometimes we feel like we become dissociated from ourselves and from the work in its promotion. But, you know, at the end of the day, Annie, it's also a gift. It's also truly a gift that this is possible. So, you know, I think it's good to acknowledge the difficulties, but then I'm 100% committed to talking the talk, to promoting myself on Twitter, to promoting others on Twitter, to engaging with the community, because Miss Metaverse, this collection, is exhibiting at Art to Buy with a leading art gallery. And I met Melissa Vidarich on Twitter. So the opportunities are real. I have collectors reaching out to me, real collectors, real humans reaching out saying, I love this collection. I am registering my interest. I want to acquire an edition. And so all these events are happening that are transformative for my life as an artist because of being online.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I think, you know, that interaction with the collector is important as well, because I think for many collectors, it's not that they are getting the art piece. They also want to get access to the artist and be able to actually have dialogues with them, get, you know, create relationships with them beyond the art as well, right? So I think that accessibility of kind of, you know, giving them the chance to learn more about the artist, about the journey, about the backstory of that art piece that they are interested in is part of the thing, right? It's part of the full package. It's not like they are getting only the poem. They are getting the experience as well. And part of the experience is, you know, the engagement with the artist firsthand as well. Mm-hmm. For many, it's important. So you mentioned that, you know, obviously sometimes you end up with collectors that are, you know, that have this pivotal kind of, you know, role in the career of an artist. Like, you know, if a well-respected collector likes your work, promotes you, talks about you to other collectors, that itself can change massively the whole journey. Mm-hmm. So many artists, I feel like very often there is this, especially when you are looking for that very first collector in the very beginning, many have this desperation, this frustration in their journey. And sometimes, like, they may do stuff that would be the opposite, that would have the opposite effect. It may annoy, it may be a bit kind of, you know, awkward and all that stuff. And many are actually, struggling, figuring out how to approach this, how to make it right, how to make it, you know, feel natural and you know, how to actually talk to collectors. What was your experience like in the very beginning? Like, how did you learn to navigate that whole kind of human aspect of it?
I think you learn by doing. You learn by doing, and you learn by making mistakes too. I've made so many mistakes and, you know, things that you're like, oh, I wish I'd never done that. But you learn by doing, truthfully. And I also think that nobody can pretend to be an expert in this, Ani. You know, I've had meetings. I just recently moved to Madrid, and I've started meeting recently with a few curators here who have taken an interest in my work. And, you know, they're really interested specifically in my relationship with collectors, because that feels very new to them. They're not used to necessarily with artists playing that role, with the artists directly engaging with the collectors. And so they're very curious about how that has developed, if collectors, you know, of course there's an economic interest there too. They want to know, you know, if we were to do something with you, like, are there collectors out there? And at the end of the day, what Web3 really does give you as an artist is the possibility. There's no guarantee, but there's a possibility of building a collector base that can be very loyal and can help really sustain the practice, right? And also starts growing and developing as you grow as an artist as well. But it's a balancing act between, you know, exhibiting at the right places, having, I think, a healthy price point. In addition, at the beginning, I started selling my work very, very inexpensively for a very long time. And the prices, of course, have increased. And I also release work very deliberately, quite slowly. But that's just because I work that way. I've had a sort of a few releases that were mushed together in a way that was too quick for me last year, but that was not planned. It was, you know, delays and things like that. Usually I like to space things out quite progressively so that I can give each collection time to digest and people to understand each piece. I think that it's really important to, once you do have a collector who's collected your work a few times, you know, perhaps write them and say, hey, thank you. Just thank you, I think, is enough to start. And then that might lead to more, right? That might lead to a relationship. It might not. But it's you know, just because somebody follows you back or acquires a really, really inexpensive edition doesn't mean you're going to flood their inbox with 10 other pieces that you have available, you know?
No, of course. No, definitely. Especially since, like, you know, many artists have very different pieces, right? Like the style may be similar, but, like, you know, you never know what collector actually found in that specific piece that resonated with him, that kind of, you know, led to that decision, right? So there is no guarantee that all the other pieces will resonate the same way, or, you know, will evoke the same emotions. So I totally agree with you. Kind of, you know, spamming and chasing collectors by itself is not a good practice, and it may be a bit annoying for sure. So I'm with you on that approach. I do the same. You know, I just message back, and then if they come back for conversation or, you know, more, and it clicks and you build relationship, great. If no, then great as well. I mean, it is what it is. But you mentioned something that is very interesting, and I think it's worth talking about, which is the price point. Because I have spoken to so many artists, and especially the ones who are just starting, they have so much self-doubt, and they kind of, you know, have the self-confidence issues, and if they haven't sold anything yet, for them it's very hard to understand how to approach pricing at all. Like, some even have this guilt feeling associated with, oh my god, art is such a pure thing, how can I commercialize it, how can I put, you know, a price tag to it, how can I sell it, it's part of my soul. So How are you looking at that aspect of the journey?
When I started in Web3, I'd already published several books. I was lucky enough to have received several literary awards as well. But honestly, you start from zero in Web3. And I think that is something to keep in mind. Of course, if you're a major, major international artist who's exhibited at certain places and you're coming in with a strong platform, you will be advised and priced differently, and you probably already have a collector base. But even if you come with a trajectory that you think somehow should be priced into your work in Web3, I think that it's helpful to start pretty low and gradually build up, especially if you're just getting your work out there for the first time. That was my case for sure. I had never sold a digital poem. And so I started, you know, at $100 for a one-on-one. That was it. And now, you know, the price has changed quite significantly for me. Not massively, and I also don't increase from work to work. I stay at a certain level for quite some time. And like I said, I don't release too many works, especially one-of-one poems. I don't release very many of those. Just because it takes so much out of me to produce them. And I usually work with other artists, or I work with a studio. So it's costly also for me to create these works. I definitely can't, you know, have dozens out there at once. Start low, I would say, Ani. Start low and really also I think that it's important to have a message as an artist, to have a why, and to have a reason why you're doing what you're doing and why this is important to your practice. Of course, sustainability is a valuable reason, but I think if you are able to transmit your vision in a way that's compelling and that accompanied by your artwork as well, of course, then it's very possible to connect with a great collector base in Web3.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And it's kind of, you know, at the end of the day, no matter which format you're picking, which vertical of art you are part of, it all is about storytelling, right? It tells story, like photographs tell stories, poems tell stories, like, you know, fiction tell stories, the painting as well. So it all comes back to that, you know, universal human sort of, you know, a basic thing that evokes emotions and feelings and brings back memories and kind of, you know, creates experiences and all that stuff, no matter which tool or which format you are using, right? But in our case, for writers, it's a bit more challenging, because if a painter can just paint the thing and do the project from start to finish, we kind of have this challenge of how do we visualize it? Because if it's just, you know, the poem the way it is, and if it's just the text on a white sheet of kind of, you know, digital paper or whatever, probably it's not as compelling as something different, right? So what was your approach? Like, how did you think about, okay, I have this poem, I have this, what it represents, right? What the feeling it has, what the message it has, but how do I put it into shape or form that, you know, that should be minted as an end result? Like, what was your process? Because I know that for me it was challenging. Like, okay, you know what? Like, I don't want it to be boring. I want to make something exciting out of it. But like, what do I do? And also, I think it took me a while to accept the fact that most probably I can't do it myself, all by myself, from start to finish.
And that's fine. You can obviously work with another artist, Ani. Collaborations in Web3 are common and very well received. It's also, yeah, you know, you learn a lot, of course, from working with somebody else. And also then there's two people sharing the piece, two people connecting with collectors, two people communicating why it's important in the world. And that's helpful for sure. Another aspect is that you can always find somebody who perhaps wants to bring your vision to life, and you can hire them and, you know, establish a fee to do that. For me, I think it's really important to have a sound element.
Yeah.
The fact that we can infuse poems with our voice is quite powerful for me. I really spend a lot of time recording myself and making sure that the delivery of the poem is as impeccable as mm-hmm. possible. And sometimes it's not even about it being impeccable, but as faithful to the emotion of the poem.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes it's actually full of glitches or full of breaths or full of moments of pause and self-correction, and that's intended. And that's, I think, something that digital poems have that, of course, printed poems don't. And it makes it for a very intimate and visceral experience for the listener. And there's many ways to bring your poems to life. Of course, you know, there's tools that are simple to use, such as Canva. Anyone can use Canva. That's readily available. And there's also platforms where you can mint text-only versions. And yeah, that's enough as well. So I think that there's lots of options, and nothing is, you know, the one way to go. It's good to explain.
Yeah. No, I think that's the beauty of it, right? We are at a stage in a space where everyone is experimenting, and, you know, I'm certain that with the time, some people will be discovering new ways of doing things, new type of things that that they will be creating, and different new approaches of promoting it, and kind of, you know, and so there is a lot of space, as you said, like no one knows exactly what the right and wrong is. There are no rules, so we're just kind of, you know, playing around and experimenting and finding out different ways that fit best for us and for our art, right? Because, you know, we're all different, we have completely different perspectives, different processes of producing things, and different type of people that will resonate with us. So I mean, I personally don't really look at competition as something bad, because I feel like we're so, each of us is so unique that there is no sort of direct competition per se, right? It's like, you know, how do you compare like someone's poem to someone else's poem, for example, mm-hmm. or, you know, someone's poem to someone else's painting? It's just, I don't even know how to do that, right? So, but talking about competition, like, you know, there are many people who, like, competitions matched up with sort of niche, right? There are many people who kind of pick a sort of specific style, and then, you know, they have a certain collectors who prefer that style, right? And they just stick to that. There are some others who, like me, I just like experimenting. I don't want to stick to one thing and do the same thing in different variations, because I myself as an artist get bored out of it, right? So and then in each niche, in each style, you end up having similar artists, and kind of, you know, and at the end of the day, if a collector can buy only one piece at that point of time, obviously there is a bit of competition for attention, competition for the sale itself, and all that stuff. How that dynamic has been, because I know, like, we artists keep supporting each other, and we're very, like, I've never had any sort of toxic competing feelings or envy or anything kind of, you know, directed to me or from me, but like, how the dynamic works, how do you feel about that? Because especially in the bear market, I presume things were much harder, so how did that work out?
You know, I think this is the first time I get asked this question. It's not something I've really ever thought about. I guess I don't see it really affecting me in my practice or in my experience of transacting and presenting it necessarily. I'm really just focused on sharing my work. And at the end of the day, acquisitions are very important. They're very important, of course. But they're also not everything. And I feel that I have been able to present my work and connect with collectors, even though many other works are selling and selling for much more than mine, of course, you know, and faster than mine and all that. But I'm just really focused on delivering a message consistently and continuously. I am, you know, every day I'm putting out my thoughts into the ether. And little by little, they've been connecting with people who want to support my path. I don't really have much of a comment, I guess, in terms of competition. I don't really feel like I guess I fit into many categories. I'm not really, mm-hmm. know, artist or an AR artist, or I call myself a literary artist, because that's the best I could come up with to describe what it is that I do, which is engage with language. But I also engage with classic literature and try to connect new audiences to it via my artworks. So that, I think, encompasses in a more broader way, you know, poet, artist. I think literary artist defines it as close mm-hmm. as possible.
Yeah, no, completely makes sense. Let's go to the, I guess, like the one of the recent highlights of your career. And I mean, I saw the announcement. I was super excited and happy for you. The Sotheby's auction of your work. So how did that happen? And you know, how do you feel about, so to speak, like traditional galleries' involvement in this space overall?
You know, Annie, I'm always happy to get help. And I think that it's been really helpful for me and I recommend it whenever anybody asks, to work with established art galleries who are dipping their toes into Web3 or who have been in Web3 and have been championing digital artists for a while. The first gallery that I worked with was Gazelli Art House. Their digital branch called Gazellio. They're a Mayfair, London-based gallery who have really been at the forefront of digital art for quite some time now. And I did a residency with them 2 years ago, actually. They were the first gallery really to say, you know what, we like what you're doing. Why don't you become an artist in residence? And I did, and I released a collection with them. And now I'm going to Art Dubai with them to the digital sector with Melissa Vidarek, whom I mentioned. And I couldn't be going to Art Dubai on my own. I couldn't be exhibiting, you know, at a fair like this by myself. They've given me the platform. They've given me the hand. I have tons of questions that I ask them all the time. I'm like, do you think I should do this? Can I get some feedback? And I really value that. And of course, there's a cost attached to it, but I think it's a fair cost. And I, for one, am very happy to have the help. I've also worked with a gallery based in Berlin called Office in Part on a series called Being Borges. And I have been asking questions every single step of the way to the gallerist, saying, you know, what do you think of this? Help me. And it's been a dialogue. It's been a collaboration. I feel like we've birthed the collection together. And I completely value this support. There's bad, of course, actors always out there in the world. And I think that there's so many important ones. Another curator, for example, who's been absolutely crucial, two curators that I have to mention are Annika Meyer and Nicole AP from Vertical Crypto. I mean, they've both, from the very beginning, sort of saw something different in my work and have helped me present it in settings that have given it credibility. So that's another thing that galleries do, Ani, is they can help give you credibility, of course, you know, if you're working with the correct one.
Yeah, I mean, and definitely, like, you know, Sotheby being one of the biggest and most prestigious ones, I mean, I can imagine that that's kind of, you know, something that is speaking about the pivotal developments of the artist journey. I truly believe this will be one of those, right? So how was the experience like? Like, you know, did they approach you, or like how does like one get to that level of galleries, essentially?
It was actually through the curator of this digitally native sale that they had based on ordinals, which are artworks inscribed onto the Bitcoin blockchain. And the curator, named Francisco Alarcón, known as Oxfar on Twitter, is a friend. And he and I met, and he mentioned to me that he was curating this exhibition and that there was a way to inscribe text only onto Bitcoin, and that he thought it would be really interesting to include one of my poems in this exhibition, because it was hinged around the archaeology of the chain. It had some really old inscriptions, some very new inscriptions, but he didn't have a text-only inscription. And he thought that, you know, as a digital poet, as someone really active in Web3, that he wanted to have one of my works. And immediately I said, you know, that I would be honored, that it sounded like a wonderful way to present my work. And so that's how this came along. It came along because I think I've been active in this space for quite some time. I have been sharing my work, my poems, and I'm doing something that I think is innovative and pretty new, so that it you know, piqued his interest to include it in the exhibition.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And I think that those are the two things that kind of, you know, we touched upon already. And I think I would like to emphasize it even further. So basically being consistent, putting out good quality art at, you know, on regular basis, and at the same time being active, being part of the community, engaging and talking to people, making friends, and you know, being participating actively in the ecosystem in general. Because I know us artists are very tempted to sort of, you know, get isolated, get into that environment, dive deep into the, you know, kind of creation mode, and you know, ideally not get distracted by anything else at that period, right? But as we already said, it's just those relationships are so valuable, keeping an eye on what's happening. And I mean, to me, what helps me a lot is I get inspired by other creators and what they create, and by, you know, consuming and looking and kind of, you know, seeing all this stuff that comes out by other artists, that too kind of, you know, motivates, and that too sort of, you know, brings in new ideas, and you know, you get exposed to loads of different things you never thought about before. So that too helps you kind of digest it in some way, modify it, come up with your own things that you would like to add to it. So I think, yeah, I mean, being active in the space and being part of it is very important and very valuable to both sides. It's not just, you know, you bringing things into it, you're also kind of, you know, taking a lot as well, and it's yeah, it's rewarding for sure. You mentioned Bitcoin ordinals, and I guess, you know, that would be a good segue to discuss blockchains. You know, like, you know, which ones to pick, where to go, because I remember during those peak periods when, you know, everything was hyped and very active, many had the preference of the Ethereum blockchain, and that was the main place, even though the gas fees were so high. Most of the artists were minting on it because most of the collectors preferred to collect Ethereum art. Tezos at one point was considered sort of, yeah, not good enough and cheaper blockchain. And now things are changing. Now we have Tezos, now we have Solana, now we have the Bitcoin ordinals. So the options are very diverse. Different collectors have different preferences. Some collectors are open to all, obviously. But for the artist, obviously, like, you know, it's going to be very hard to start with all of them, and it kind of maybe doesn't really make so much sense, maybe picking one and then starting diversifying further with the time would be smarter. But how did you go about this?
I began with Ethereum. I began with OpenSea, which is huge, of course, massive platform where you can have your work available to, and it's, you know, you don't need an invitation, anybody can mint on OpenSea. And I also quickly started minting as well on Tezos, because Tezos is very, very inexpensive for artists to get started on. There's hardly any fees, and also there's a culture of artists collecting each other's work, so you really do get, it's quite easy, let's say, to get some traction early on, and you can mint editions. So you can have one artwork with, you know, 20 editions at really affordable prices that you start sharing to get your name out there. And I think that it's also, you know, it's if you can, it's also helpful to collect the work of other artists. I can't tell you how many, you know, how many times, Annie, I have to say, there is a collector in the space who now wants to start making their own art, and they're a notable collector. And they reach out to me, you know, many times saying how much they love my work, and they're, you know, supportive on Twitter. And then they start writing me, asking me for help. Like, you know, can you read my description and edit it? Or can you tell me what name I should give my collection? And it's, you know, I scratch my head a little bit because they haven't collected any of my work, but they're notable collectors in the space. And I always wonder, you know, are they reaching out to the male artist whose work they collect, the big male artist whose work they collect and share, and asking them to, you know, help them edit their artwork description statement or their artist statement or their bio? And, you know, probably not. And so those are the kind of messages that I completely disregard these days, because it feels extractive to women and to artists. So, you know, if you're getting started and you have the possibility of supporting an artist that you admire, I would suggest, you know, you can support them on Twitter. That's always, always very well received. And if you can, and don't feel pressured if you cannot, but if you can collect, you know, small editions of their work, and say, hey, you know, I love your work. I collected this edition, and you start building a relationship, then I think it's possible that you can even ask for help going forward. I think that's a question that is possible and that is reasonable and respectful.
No, I totally agree with you, because I don't really like that dynamic when people approach you out of nowhere with an ask right away, without having built that relationship in place beforehand. And I feel like, you know, when we spoke about being active and building a relationship, I think both of us meant like genuine relationship and not the transactional ones, because, you know, the transactional ones kind of, you know, when people approach you with a hidden agenda and with a specific goal where they just, you know, need something for themselves, people feel it, people can sense it, and it's just not, it doesn't feel fair, it doesn't feel valuable, and at some point it doesn't even matter who that person is, right? Like whether it's a respectful collector or a well-known person or an influencer, it just doesn't really matter. On the other note, I'm surprised about the ask, because like many artists are trying to figure out how collectors think and what kind of description they would like to see and what would attract them and what would make them resonate with the artwork so much that they would be compelled to buy it, right? So for a collector who's been on that side already, they probably should know better how to do that, right?
And literally, it just happened to me last week. So I was a little bit, it's happened to me so many times, Anya, but it happened to me last week, you know, where a collector wrote me saying, oh, I'm going to release my first collection. Can you please read and revise? And do you have comments? And do you have suggestions? And I hadn't responded. And then, you know, they've never collected any of my work. And a couple of days later, I see that they, you know, had acquired a huge piece by Death Beef. And they're sharing it on Twitter. And I'm like, are you writing Death Beef and asking Death Beef to edit your artist statement and give you, you know, suggest names for your collection? Or are you writing me because, you know, I'm a nice woman?
No, I get what you're saying for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's, I know that you're also, when we spoke about being active in the space, I know that there are several crypto writer, crypto poet communities and Twitter chats, and I'm very quiet in those, but I'm in some of them, so I do follow what's happening, obviously. How does that work? Like, if someone comes to the space and gets like, you know, is it open to everyone to join, or like, do you need to know someone who's there who would just bring you in? Or like, you know, if people want to become active and be part of those communities and are creating literary, you know, NFT art, what's the way to be part of a bigger community?
Well, I think that if you're out there and you're sharing your work and you're engaging with other writers, you'll definitely get asked to join sort of the Twitter groups, and you'll sort of build your own too. You know, I don't think necessarily joining some of the established ones should be your end goal. Rather, perhaps you can create your own group of new people who've come and who are active and who want to do similar work. I'm a co-founder of a digital poetry gallery called The Verse Verse, and we are a collective of writers and poets. But really, Annie, our mission is to onboard some of the leading voices in contemporary poetry to the blockchain and hold our hand a little bit. So we're not open to submissions. You know, we're not, we don't really have open calls, for example. But I think we learn a lot from watching how we share poets on Twitter, how we share poets on Instagram, how we exhibit the work, how we also facilitate collaborations between artists and poets and curators to present these works in really compelling settings. And I think that that could serve as a learning, let's say, mechanism, somebody who's new to the scene. We do ETH, we do Tezos, we're on several blockchains, and we also host, you know, regular Twitter spaces to help educate. But we do get a lot of questions about, you know, hey, can I join, or how do I get my work on the Verse? And, you know, that's not really what our mission is. Our mission is more like a gallery where we're very, very slow and conscious about the work that we're bringing onto the Verse.
Yeah, no, totally makes sense. I mean, recently, a few days ago, like, we saw the whole Sora thing and how much AI can visualize stuff based on your prompts and word inputs and stories. What do you think, how is it going to impact the literary works and literary artists? Is it opening more possibilities to actually be able to do stuff by themselves from start to finish? Or, like, you know, how do you imagine this? Are artists compelled to try it out and experiment with these new ways of showcasing their literature?
I hope so. I hope it makes it easier for poets to get started visualizing their verse in a way that they feel comfortable sharing online. I can only hope that that is the case, Ani. I certainly want to try it and play around with it and see what may result. I think that, you know, we have to really acknowledge how intelligent and how well crafted and well trained people in Web3 are. It is definitely not an amateur community. You know, make no mistake, it's full of some of the smartest, most talented humans that I have ever met. So by no means can you just, you know, throw something together and put it online and expect, you know, that it's going to fly. It is a space where people have been doing things for a very long time and are very well trained.
Okay. Yeah. I'm eager to experiment as well. So I can't wait for it to be out and see, like, how it works and how much of it we can use for our works. I think it's going to be fun. That whole collaboration. I mean, it's one thing to collaborate with people. It's another thing to collaborate with code. So it's going to be interesting to see what the experience would be like and how much learning curve we will have to climb before it gets to the, I'm sure, like, the examples are we won't really just, you know, input our poem and get such examples that we saw already shared online, but it will take a while before that. So start dropping this out, maybe. I mean, you already mentioned that you have a project, a collaborative project that is coming out soon, and you briefly spoke about the concept. Would you like to add more to it, or, you know, are there anything else in the future plans that you're looking into? What does the future look like?
Well, I have a book coming out in May that I'm very excited about. It's called Mammo, and it's been a really, really difficult work to get out in the world. It's been almost a decade of work.
Oh, wow.
And getting it published and finding the right publisher. And the whole process has been a long, very, very deliberate journey. See you at Art Dubai. I will have Miss Metaverse will be at the Gazelli Art House booth in the digital sector. And I will have a one-of-one work called Waiting Room, in which I perform my verse with my body for the very first time. I filmed it with one of Spain's top photographers in his studio. It's a completely new fork in my creative work. And I'm excited to present it to the world.
Wow, that's, I really love the fact that it's so different and diverse in terms of formats and the way you present your story, your work. I think it's really great because we do need that fresh element all the time, right? That new approaches and new ways of presenting work. So I really love that. I want to wish you success in all the future endeavors, and it was really nice to catch up with you, and I'm sure artists that are either already in the space or are looking into entering the space. I think this was very useful, and you have an inspirational story. So I think, like, you know, the advice was very down to earth, and we didn't really give any stories that are made up. It's the real experiences and real stories and things that actually happened to both of us. So I think it's very useful. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you so much, Annie. I really, really appreciate your time.
That's all that I've got for you today. If you want more of my content, please check out my newsletter at annealexander.com/subscribe, and I'll see you in the next episode.